is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to Andrew Lipstein, who is here in New York, where I am, and I want to make sure I get it right. He's established OS and 1S.
Mm-hmm. Zeros and ones.
Zeros and ones. Right, very good. Mm-hmm. And pure digital publishing business.
That's right. Thanks for having me.
No, really glad to have you here. So I think I heard about what you were doing through some, you know, newsletter or some, I can't even remember what it was, mm-hmm. but I was really instantly interested in what you're doing, partially because it's pure digital and I'm interested in digital publishing and where that's going to go, but also because your model is to sell direct to readers. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what inspired you both as a writer, as a publisher, and now as an aggregator of other publishers to essentially become a retailer of books.
Sure. Yeah, the process was very fast in developing an idea, and there were a lot of pivots involved. It originally started that I had a friend up in Toronto, Victoria Hetherington, whose book I Have to Tell You we're publishing. And I was talking with her about the process of finding an agent and going through a publishing house and doing that entire dance and, you know, the frustrations of it, and sort of decided I wanted to pursue opening a publishing house myself. So I started to talk to a few other publishers. I talked to one of the guys at OR Books, who I found. There was an article about Amazon, The New Yorker, earlier this year. That was also definitely a source of inspiration. And talked to publishers about, small publishers, about what their biggest qualms were and what their biggest frustrations were, and tried to think about the system that was happening in the simplest way possible, and to sort of like remove what was going on right now and just think what would make the most sense. And for physical books, that's a whole other story. I thought that Amazon, what they do is terrific, and what they do no one else can do because they're efficiency ninjas. But for ebooks, something that is fundamentally as simple as exchanging money for information, there should be extremely low takes from the retailer. And Amazon is taking a good deal of money from publishers, and I think a lot of publishers are frustrated. And obviously, you know, the elephant in the room is Hachette, which is the publisher that has enough backing to actually fight back and sort of bring this issue to you know, mainstream attention.
Well, do you think, well, it's aside from the financial issues, mm-hmm. do you think that, one of the challenges that most publishers feel they have selling direct, again, leaving aside that they, retailers that they deal with may find it, something that they don't feel good about, having publishers competing directly with them. Mm-hmm. But essentially, as a startup, you can bypass all of the existing relationships that have been established.
Yeah. I mean,
one thing that happened when ebooks were, I don't want to say invented, but when ebooks became, in the last 10 years that ebooks have kind of come to the fore, to a great extent, it was because Amazon was in a position to promote ebooks, to build a device, to integrate the selling online with the device in your hand. And so a lot of publishers kind of fell into the traditional model of selling a containerized ebook on a device that
right.
looks a lot like a book. It was meant
yeah.
sort of existentially meant to comfort readers and make them feel like the ebook was something familiar, even though it's different.
Right.
And that's kind of where we got, how we got to where we are now, which
right.
is that publishers deal with retailers and wholesalers to some extent, replicating in the e-world what existed in the print world.
Mm-hmm.
What you're implying or saying, and I think is true, is that it's not necessarily required for that structure to exist for a publisher.
Yes, exactly. So, the emergence of new technology is a pattern that never breaks. Whenever something new comes along, you need someone who has the financial backing to make it happen, both production and engineering and all of that. And then once you do that, there's sort of this chaotic disequilibrium moment where the technology exists for everyone to take advantage of, but they still have proprietary claim over a lot of sort of the information. So it's much easier for you just to purchase a Kindle because you know Amazon, you know it's going to be easy. And that's why Amazon has the hand over other big corporations, not even the small guys. I'm talking iBooks and Kobo and obviously Nook. I think when Amazon came out, there was definitely a point in time where the Nook, I would even say, probably had a more of a market share. Now, I don't know if that's right, but I mean, don't you remember it seeming
probably,
like...
No, I think it didn't because Kindle was first and Nook, you know, was a kind of second place runner-up.
Uh-huh.
I think Kindle, I hate to say it, but I think Amazon handily beat Barnes & Noble, both getting there first and maybe having at the initial stage a better device. But they also, at that stage, you know, and still to this day, you know, Amazon is probably 7 to 8 times bigger in online sales than Barnes & Noble is. Mm-hmm. If you look at the two together, Barnes & Noble sells, I don't know what, maybe 75 or 80% the number of books that Amazon does. But online, Amazon beats them 8 or 9 to 1. But I think what you're saying is correct, and that is that the device idea took over, you know, at that moment, seemed like the best way to build a market.
Right.
Now, but you guys, in your business, you're going to sell direct and you're going to be fulfilling, you know, I've been on your site. I can buy an ebook directly from you for $6, which is a really good price.
That's right.
So, you know, as the publisher, you can offer me, the consumer, full value. You don't have to mark it up.
Yeah, and the other big thing about our business model that's different from Amazon is that we are first of all DRM free, and I'm sure you know all about DRM. For those listening who don't, DRM is basically an encryption that makes it so when you buy a book from Amazon, they're fundamentally putting it on your Kindle themselves, and they reserve the right to take it off. Now they'll never do that. There's only been one example where they've actually done that, but you don't fundamentally own the file. There's two issues with this, I find. One is that DRM is incredibly easy to encrypt. Basically, any popular book out there that's been produced by a major publisher has been DRM encrypted, but you can get it without. So we're spending money on something that is fundamentally not useful. And it's also, in a way, taking rights away from the reader, I find. So we sell books DRM-free. You buy the book, you get the PDF, the EPUB, and the MOBI.
Right. Which, so you're saying your model is in that way fundamentally different because in every sale, so-called, that Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, or Apple makes, they're really it's really a license.
It's a license, yeah.
And not a transfer of ownership. It's simply a license.
It's more complex. It's
like software.
Exactly.
You have the right to use it. You don't have the right to copy it. You don't have the right to share it.
Right.
And you're saying in your model, because it's non-DRM, you're not protecting it from being shared.
Right.
I can buy it from you. I could send it to a friend.
Right. We hope you don't. We hope that friend buys it. But if you're going to do it, you're going to do it anyway.
Well, we could also argue that if I send it to a friend, I'm saying with enthusiasm, this is something I really think you should read because the books that you're publishing don't suffer. Well, they have a different problem than bestsellers. A bestseller, mm-hmm. you know, a publisher of a bestseller has to protect their book against piracy. I would argue that you would almost want piracy because it's a form of marketing.
Well, so I agree that the books I'm covering, obviously, there's a difference between critical success and mainstream success, and we would want them to reach more eyes. I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't go as far as say we want piracy because, you know, my mission is to bring success to the publishers I work with and to sell their books. But the best case scenario is for someone to send their friend a book. Their friend says, you know what? This publisher trusted me. I'm going to buy it anyway.
Exactly. I love this book and I want to support the writer. I want to support the reader. No, and in fact, you have that opportunity as a startup because you can build the relationship with readers mm-hmm. on a one-to-one basis of trust at the outset. One of the problems with DRM is that the retailer is saying to the consumer, I don't trust you. That's a terrible way to start a relationship.
But you're saying, I don't trust you. It's as if I left a sandwich in this room and said, you know, I don't trust you, but you can't eat it, and then walk away forever.
Right.
It doesn't matter. You can eat the sandwich if you want. You could send the book to someone. You could find it online DRM-free, even if it's been DRM. So why are we doing this?
So I buy the book. from you, and you've already explained. Now, you're going to give me all three, the three files.
You get all three of them.
Right, and potentially if I'm a Kindle reader, I know that I need the Mobi. I mean, I always wonder how many readers actually know what the file names are. You know, this is something that we've worried about. That
right, side loading is what it's called, yes, when you put the file on your
right
device.
And so, what's your experience been so far? I know it's you're yeah new, but you're gonna develop a pretty good understanding of how consumers, how readers act around devices and files.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and traditionally, I think I know you. I saw you have Zenk on your list as one of the publishers mm-hmm that you work with, and I talked to them years ago when they first started selling direct, and they had, you know, they developed a pretty good system of explaining to their readers what the files were and how to download them and then how to sideload them onto the device, because
yeah
so many people really don't know how to do that.
So, yeah, so first of all, when I send the email, I have a link to a page explaining all of it. I asked the same question you're asking me to the editor at OR when I started, because they do DRM-free. And it's obviously an issue, but he was extremely optimistic. And so recently, my girlfriend's aunt, who I think is upper 60s, maybe 70, she has an e-reader, and I asked her to go through it and to figure it out. And she did it extremely comfortably. Now, obviously, that's sample size one.
Right.
But I do think that people are, A, willing to learn something new that they feel is maybe 2 or 3 years ahead, and B, very likely to teach someone else once they have done it themselves. I think that ideas that catch on usually have a teaching component of them, that there's something to be learned and then something to be taught.
Well, and it feels good to learn something that
exactly
you didn't know
yeah
how to do before.
And to understand this device that you're actually using.
Right.
Yeah.
So have you had, I mean, again, the thing I'm curious about is how reading will evolve, you know, in terms of devices or reading on screens of different types.
Right.
EPUB gives you the opportunity to read on almost any device.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recommend, for instance, like, let's say I've got an Android phone, which I do.
Mm-hmm.
I did a little, you know, I'm in the, you know, I'm sort of fairly knowledgeable, so I found the, you know, found a reader that I liked, and it's Aldico, and, you know, I think pretty generally it's well thought of as a reading app, reading app for Android.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have you explored, you know, kind of figuring out what you think is the best reader for every, you know, for different devices that people might have?
Yeah, so I have a definite preference. It's a personal preference, but it's one. So I, when I'm done with work, I prefer not to see a screen of any sort. I actually don't have a smartphone, so apps are out of the question. So I prefer the first generation Kindle, the ones with the ink and the magnet,
yep,
so you're not actually looking at a screen. I found it works in all light, and that I don't get that fatigue of just being inside of a light source.
So let's supposing I was a customer of yours,
mm-hmm,
and I say, you know, I don't own a Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't own an iPad.
Mm-hmm.
I don't own a Kobo. I don't own a Nook. I don't want to buy one.
Right.
I got a cell phone. I'm a smartphone person. You know, smartphones are.
And they want an app recommendation.
And they say, how do I read on my smartphone? What are you going to tell them?
Well, if they're asking me in person, my answer would be PDF is the way to go. If not, I would spend the next 5 minutes researching as hard as possible to find the best app to sound as knowledgeable as possible.
Right.
And maybe, you know what, after this conversation, I'll go home
well,
and
no,
have
I'm
a better answer.
You know, the reason I brought it up is that I'm probably premature, but I'm thinking that you will learn a whole lot.
Oh, my God. Yeah, yeah. About this realm that I
yeah
have. Oh,
and,
absolutely.
And the
sure
customers, people, I mean, I hope you get a lot of people,
right,
but I hope people, you know, I think there's just an incredible range of responses possible, you know, from the person who says, like you,
right,
I don't like the feeling of the screen. I want something that releases me from that idea, to the person who says, once I found a smartphone and I got an app to read books and that's all I ever have done.
Mm-hmm.
I know people who read on their smartphones. That's all they read on anymore.
Right.
So you're going to have the whole range, you know, people who read on an iPad. They like some people say like the iPad Mini. It's the best experience of all.
Mm-hmm.
It's fairly light. Screen's really nice. Other people, very few, I would say, but some people will read on laptops.
Yeah. I think continuity is a huge thing.
I mean, being able to switch between devices.
Between devices, which you need an app for, obviously.
Right.
My dad has told me 7 or 8 times how much he loves Netflix because he could pause 24 at home and then go to the gym and then continue where he's at.
Well, and you know, this is true of both the Nook and the Kindle apps, I will say, because I use them both. Mm-hmm. If I'm reading a book on my cell phone and then I switch to the iPad, the app knows and says, you've read this far on another device. Do you want to sync to that? I say, yeah, that's pretty cool, mm-hmm. because then I don't have to figure out where I was. That, I think, is powerful. That's the only reason why the PDF idea might not be so good if somebody is thinking about that. Mm-hmm. But if you only read on one device, you don't care. There's nothing else, you know, you don't have to sync it to another device.
I guess the best answer is that I hope people find the book so enthralling they can't even stop to begin with.
Right. They read them, buy it, read
no
it.
No continuity necessary.
And do you invite readers to then talk to you about the books that they've read? You know, is that something you're interested in, kind of developing a relationship with your readers?
Sure. I mean, down the road, sure. I think intuitively that's a wonderful idea. I also think that involving the social aspect in any startup or any company is immediately appealing, but I think extremely dangerous in muddying the value prospect and just the user experience. I've seen a lot of startups and apps that I've heard a lot of press on, and I go to their website, and it's just hard to figure out what exactly they are.
Well, that's an interesting point.
What they're doing.
Yeah.
Now, Goodreads, which I think is an exceptional company, does one thing, and they do it fantastic.
Right.
And as far as engaging readers, I would be more interested in pursuing a relationship with a company like Goodreads than doing my own social thing. I don't think, honestly, it would be successful, and I think it would blur what we do.
Yep. No, that's a good point.
Yeah.
That because in order to be good at social, you would have to invest a ton of resources. Mm-hmm. And because people expect now, you know, if you say social, they're going to expect it to be like Goodreads
mainstream.
Or like Facebook, you know, with lots of features and mm-hmm. lots of capabilities. And you're right. That's probably not a good idea for you to do.
Yeah.
So the other thing you've done, which I think is really interesting, it's not just your own books. You're selling about 12 other publishers.
It's actually up to 17.
17. Okay. So
it will soon be probably up to 20.
So tell me about what got you thinking about inviting other publishers to participate. Mm-hmm. And then what did you do, you know, to get them?
Yeah. So there are a few publishers I definitely immediately admired, and they're the ones that I wanted to get, and I wanted to figure out how to sell their books. One was Coach House Books in Toronto, who's been doing it for a very long time, and oddly enough, they've always been on the curve of technology.
Yep.
That meant printing back in the 70s or 60s, but they were. It's funny, one of the biggest inspirations I actually never ended up getting, Fiction Collective 2.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, a producer from the 70s, pretty much. And all their material is through, I think, the University of Alabama. And I started a conversation with them, and it just, you know, it actually just evaporated, the conversation. But I wanted to get them so badly that it just sort of motivated me to seek out what other groups I hadn't heard of. Just starting conversations with publishers I admired and then figuring out how I could serve them, I guess.
So essentially you're acting as their, you know, it's almost like a distributor or a retailer.
Both.
Right?
Yeah.
So you sell their books for the same, for what price?
So all books are $6, and the percentage that they get is the exact same as those I would give, let's say, Victoria. They get 80% sans e-commerce cost, so that turns out, so they get $4.42 for a resale.
Did you bought a generic e-commerce package or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, all of them across the board are pretty much the same.
So you take PayPal, credit card?
I don't think I take PayPal. I do take all credit cards.
And are you having publishers now coming to you and asking to participate?
I am, yeah. And I'm slow to take them because I think that there's legs to get a lot more on board, but I want to make sure that The ones I do take are very close to the ones that are already taken. Now, that obviously is not conducive to having a great selection and something that might appeal to all readers, but I don't want to trip over myself.
Well, it may be better to be to not be a general retailer of books. It
right.
may be better to be, in fact, I mean, people talk about this as this sort of curatorial role,
yeah.
but it makes sense to have writing that is, well, it's not necessarily coherent, but a selection that is coherent.
Yeah, so
that makes sense.
The curation model is something that I want to from the beginning. So right now we're only taking two books from each publisher we work with. We won't take any more. That might change a little bit down the road, maybe sooner than later. But yeah, we haven't, some publishers have wanted to give us more and we've said, let's choose the two that you think fit best for this and then we'll take it from there.
And are you, do you have any plans or will, or have you been approached by authors directly?
Yes, definitely.
Not to be published by you, but to have you do for them the same as you've done for Coach House
yes.
and Zank. And
so right now, in the beginning, I looked up the Kirkus Indie starred reviews, the self-published, to see if there are any real all-stars that were doing it themselves and maybe could use my assistance. Now I'm not taking books that have been published previously, not by publishers, just for the same reason. I feel like once I open that floodgate, it's very hard to find the books that are actually going to fit in my collection.
Right. No, and so how would you define what goes into the
sure.
collection?
What
are the parameters?
So I think someone asked me whether their books are, I said unconventional, and they said, oh, experimental. And with any art and industry, all the words already have deep attachments.
Right.
And for me, experimental means sort of that one of your primary purposes is to escape previous tropes and paths taken. And I'm not looking for books that are, that's their primary purpose. I'm looking for books that are unconventional, that don't follow the normal plot arc while still definitely retaining the entertainment factor, which I think a lot of experimental fiction doesn't have.
Right. Do you feel like there's, you could define a style, or is it more, in other words, is there a style characteristic that unites the books that you're interested in?
A style in prose, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. And if you have to think about it a lot, it probably means the answer is
yeah,
no.
Yeah, I would say the answer is no.
Yeah.
And an answer that would also translate to no is that in describing the book, it'd be difficult to list other authors and titles that it's like.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is a characteristic
right.
of its own nature in a lot of ways.
I guess, yeah. yeah. I guess the null set, whatever.
Right. So what kind of number of titles right now feels comfortable to you? You know, if you have 17 publishers plus your own and it's two books of each, mm-hmm. you know, you're in the 45 titles range. Is there kind of a limit to the number of books that you could comfortably offer in this model, do you think?
So I guess a lot of that is how much public awareness there is of zeros and ones, because if there's zero public awareness, it would be weird if you went to a site and hadn't heard of it and there was 120 titles of all books that were experimental or, you know.
Right. Unconventional.
Man, really, really caught myself there. Unconventional books. I think that would be overwhelming. But I hope that as we grow, people will know what they're getting into when they come to the site and they've heard of it through word of mouth or heard of it from a news source and they know what it is and then can more easily parse the information given to them. So in that case, it would be great to have more publishers, more books per publisher, and then architecturally figure out a better way to present that information.
So maybe it's parsing the titles
exactly.
into groups of some kind mm-hmm. that would as subcategories.
Right. And we thought about that a lot in the beginning, but like the social, we figured, you know, in the germ phase, it's better right. to make it as simple as possible.
So, and this is very early in your launch period,
we launched last week, right?
So we're talking, and just for reference, we're talking in middle June of 2014, because somebody might be listening.
Was it 11th? June 11th?
June 12th.
June 12th, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, so, it's only been 8 days since we launched.
Okay, so we're coming in really early.
We
might want to check in with you sometime down the road
sure.
to see how it's gone. But at this early stage, would you say the response has been really positive?
Yeah, I would say, I would definitely say that. I mean, you know, we've only gotten a handful of sales so far. Obviously, that is what drives us, but I'm more interested in seeing how sticky the idea is. And from what I've seen, the idea is sticky. People are willing to talk about it, and it asks more questions than it answers, which I think is good.
That is good. And are the publishers that you've begun working with, mm-hmm. how active are they? How do you expect them to be promotional for you? You mm-hmm. know, are they you assume Coach House, Zank, all those guys have really decent mailing lists. Mm-hmm. Are they going to, you know, send out something to their own people and say, check out this new thing that we've joined?
Yeah. So, you know, in no way does our relationship have that as a need or requirement. Obviously, it's appreciated. Because when you're working with small presses, you definitely have a range of even effort or capabilities. So it would be great for that to happen, but it's some have, some haven't, and that's the way it goes.
Right. Well, that makes sense. Yeah. Some will, some won't.
Some will, some won't.
Yeah. No, I don't think right now the measure would in any way be sales. It's too early
right.
to say. I think as time goes on, it'll be, I mean, obviously sales are important. You have to do that, but
right.
engagement is really important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of, I think a lot of publishers are interested in this, in the idea. How can I sell to consumers? How can I have a relationship with consumers, with readers, the people that I'm interested in talking to that's not mediated by a third party?
Exactly.
And one way, one of the more common wisdoms is that you have to be a vertical in some way, you know, mm-hmm. that is deeply committed to a particular subject
right.
that you know so well that the community of that subject, community of interest in that subject, you're part of and you can talk to pretty readily. You're an expert in your field. But in literary publishing, that's not quite how it works. You know, you don't have to be the expert mm-hmm. in some narrow range of, you know, activity.
Yeah, well, I think for any art industry, the more you talk about someone being an expert, the more you're talking about their knowledge of the industry side of the art industry phrase. So for literary fiction, if someone were to tell me that someone's an expert in literary fiction, I can only assume they're an expert in selling literary fiction or in marketing literary fiction or in more of a historical perspective of the art. But for someone to be an expert in literary fiction, I mean, you know, not even the greatest writers or editors are experts in it.
Right.
To know what's going to stick, to know what's good right. when you get outside of it or you're too far in to tell what's good.
But in one way, you're a member of a community still. It's a
yeah,
community of
right.
interest. It maybe the terminology wouldn't be the same as in a nonfiction, you know, kind of subject area.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't cast yourself as an expert, but you would cast yourself as an active participant.
Sure, yeah.
And in that way, gaining some credibility, let's say, maybe by the virtue of the selections you make.
Sure.
It's almost what makes a great literary magazine is that the editor is able, or editors are able to capture a zeitgeist, you know,
right.
and then bring it back to the audience and say, this is who we are, but this is also an expansion of who you think you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was a great way to put it. I think the word active was also good. That's been the most exciting part for me, and this is to feel like, you know, not only am I a member of a community, but, for example, the best part is to see one sale because I see that person's name, and I just, something about having their name there is I can imagine them reading the book, and then the whole thing is, you know, much more real, that someone is reading a book that they bought on Zeros and Ones, or that I'm having a conversation with someone about fiction, and I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't really know where I was going with that. But
no, but I have a similar experience dating back to, you know, many, many years because I, you know, when I first started publishing, it was a literary magazine, which I had a subscriber list for,
mm-hmm.
and I mailed those copies out to each member of the list.
Mm-hmm.
And when they sent me their subscription, they sent me a check.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt the same exact way
yeah.
that you just described. It's like, wow, there's somebody who wants to read what I've put mm-hmm. together here, and I'm going to put it in an envelope and send it to them.
Right.
Now, you do it differently. You put it in a, you know, you send them an email essentially,
yeah.
but it's the same root experience that you can feel your customers being in some way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody who really cares enough, they've given you money.
Mm-hmm.
It's a transaction of, I think, of extreme meaning. It's one of the reasons why book selling in the personal way has been so powerful as an idea, because the bookseller and the customer are exchanging values.
Mm-hmm.
In, you know, it's not just about the money. It's this idea that I'm giving you something really important.
Right. And the fact that their digesting of it is the most personal way to consume art. You never see a movie only alone. I mean,
right.
You see a movie only alone, but you can also see with other people. Same thing with music and plays and performance art and art. But a book, you only read at your own pace. You only engage at your own speed. And you've given somebody a personal experience.
That's right. No, somebody said that to me just today, that what they loved about fiction was being lost, but in this other world.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you enter the world of the book. It allows you to leave the world of everyday life and enter the world of imagination. And that is very powerful, but it is really personal. And so that if you put down the book and, you know, talk to the person who's sitting next to you, they didn't share that experience
right.
with you. And you could share your entire life with somebody for years and have this whole other world of personal experiences that they don't share.
Right.
It's really, it's kind of metaphysical in a certain way.
It's funny because it feels so intangible, but it's also funny because reading, I think, is the most discreet, like ETE discreet, art. You know, there's only so many choices a writer can make as far as words, and it's so non-infinite that for it to be so personal, that the dissonance there is like confusing and wonderful. And
it's true.
I think what's like really interesting about even just thinking about how fiction affects people.
Yeah. I feel that way about fiction and also songs. It amazes me continually
mm-hmm.
that we can still have original songs.
Well, songs are discreet.
Yeah.
I think if you think
yeah.
about covers and
yeah.
how easy it is to recognize a song just based on a few chords.
Right. Fiction is the same way, but a little more complex.
Right.
Because it is you have to consume it through your eyes
mm-hmm.
and your imagination. But yeah, I think it is an interesting and I think an important cultural driver, a social driver for why books are important. Although this gets to another thing that I'm interested in, and that is the idea of the book as being unbound from containers.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you've thought about that at all. I've thought a lot about this recently, that, you know, ebooks, we've replicated in so many ways what a print book is.
Mm-hmm.
And yet digital is so different.
Yeah, but I definitely see where you're going there, but I think it's more of a case of novelty that's soon to wane, because books in themselves are just facsimiles of storytelling and words.
Mm-hmm.
Like music, you could say listening to an MP3 or a record is a true abstraction of someone playing live music, but for an e-reader is no more unnatural than a book, except for the fact that it involves electricity, because to even have two pages in a book is something that feels so natural because we've done it all our lives. But it's just a product of the weird way we've come to bind slices of trees together.
But do you think it'll change for generations of readers who
sure.
may no longer experience the physical book?
Yeah, I mean, I think reading an ebook is fundamentally a different experience from reading a book, in that you have a continuous flow of words. I mean, even when I started reading off an e-reader, I noticed that I was interpreting the story differently. It wasn't about feeling each chapter come to a conclusion, but just a constant flow of information, obviously. Like my kids, if they only read on e-readers, which I hope they don't, reading is going to be a different thing.
Do you think writing will be different too then?
You know, I hope not, and I think people... I mean, yes, it's going to be different. I hope it won't be significantly different. And I think that people are honestly making a bigger deal out of the effect of ebooks on writing. I mean, there's that talk on Diane Rehm's show about how the whole Amazon Hachette controversy is going to affect writing. And people were saying that, you know, people have to churn out fiction faster and faster to stay up to date. And when you reduce the costs of editors and all of that, and you're going to need a whole new model, and people are just going to be churning out you know, crap. It's I think we're knee-jerking a little bit. I don't think your readers will change writing in any significant way.
And especially maybe with literary fiction where, you know, I think it's never been commercial. So the commercial structure of the book business has not really well, maybe it has, but you could argue that it hasn't really changed the way writers think about what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it isn't about whether you're going to sell 500,000 copies. It's about mm-hmm. whether what you write really matters.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe literary fiction is insulated to a certain extent. You know, it feels like the argument about the Hachette Amazon thing is more about the structure of the industry, and where I was sort of going was more about the nature of
the personal experience of reading versus
writing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Writers to begin with, you know, mostly all of them write on digital devices. You know, it would be different if they all wrote by hand, and then through the promotion of e-readers, all of a sudden people started writing on, you know, digital word processors.
Right.
That might be
that's
more
already
of a sea
happened.
Change.
Yeah,
right.
It's already happened.
Yeah. So I think that it's just almost the consuming has now caught up with the way we produce.
Although I think that if you sat down a fairly honest writer who wrote by hand, like maybe, and there aren't very many writers who do that today, but 50 years ago, mm-hmm. you know, it was not uncommon, or writing on a manual typewriter, which is radically different than writing on a word processor
right.
on a computer. I think most people would say that there is a palpable difference in the way that you write, the way you edit, the way you think about the words.
Yeah, sure.
So it seems possible that, and of course, I have no idea what the next generation of hardware and software might look like. You know, we don't really know
mm-hmm.
Where that might go. But it does feel like there will be the potential exists that writers will think about the form, the potential of what the form offers, and maybe change that will offer possibilities that didn't exist before,
mm-hmm.
even as you lose some possibilities that only existed in the past.
Sure. Well, so I definitely see what you're saying. I mean, we're also right now in a building that helps produce audiobooks. So, I mean, audiobooks obviously aren't as popular as e-readers. They're popular, but you could ask the same question about that. And I don't think the answer would be it changes anything. If audiobooks were immensely popular, we'd have to ask ourselves, well, are more writers then going to dictate in devices their stories? And what effect will that have on storytelling?
Right.
And the answer might be a little more obvious, but I think that the effect will be less than our brains are programmed to simulate.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, and you can also get all wrapped up in the ideas seem interesting and maybe not.
Right, right.
Not so much. But I hadn't thought about that before, too, that, you know, once upon a time, as you said before, there wasn't writing. It was just storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
It was oral. It was an oral tradition. And digital technology allows for the return of that in some ways. You know, we could sit in front of these microphones and you could start telling a story.
Right. I mean, we are right now.
Yeah. Right, exactly. You could be making this all up. We have no idea. But I think that I kind of am interested in that idea, too, that you could, because on my iPad, for $3, I've bought a digital app that allows me, and it allows me to record unlimited amounts of text, or unlimited amounts of words, and I could then distribute that as an audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you could compose a story a la, a poet from the Roman time or pre-Roman times when there wasn't any writing.
Yeah.
But people aren't doing that very much, even though the technology allows it.
Yeah, well, so, you know, technology opens up a lot of doors and some of them lead to rooms that don't have anything in them.
Very well put. So I think what you're doing is really interesting. I hope that you will check in, or maybe we can talk at another point.
I'd love to.
You know, we can update this a little bit, you know, maybe 6 months, a year from now.
Yeah. Just hope there's a lot to report.
Exactly. That'd be great. Well, I really appreciate your talking to me. This is David Wilk for Publishing Talks. I've been talking to Andrew Lipstein. Zeros and ones.
That's right.
But it's O, I'm sorry, 0S-1S zeros.com.
That's right.
Which is necessary because if we just said zeros and ones, no one will find you.
Well, yeah, hopefully through Google, but
right.
That's another talk.
Well, the more you do this, the more they'll find you.
Hopefully.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
Take care.